Well, thanks for that warm introduction.
I am Dennis Ellison. I am an alcoholic.
April the 24th, 1995 is my sobriety date. And I do have a home group, principal groups of Richmond, Chesterfield. Do have a sponsor? Who has a sponsor that I know of? And I've met my sponsor and his sponsor. I haven't met my sponsor's sponsor. He lives in the New York area, so. But he talks to him often. And like I said, my sponsor and his sponsor goes to more meetings than I do. So they're very active in this program. And when I can't get my sponsor, I can get my grand sponsor. And, you know, I can see what they do in this program and I can see what they do in their lives to know that this thing works well. And if it ever stops working for them, I'll get someone else that, because it's 3 million strong in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that doesn't mean I put them on a pedestal to where I've got to always be there, you know. And I've also seen people go backwards in this thing for whatever reason or not, to stop doing it. And it tells me that in our 10th step, you know, and it tells me if we stop doing it, rest on our laurels, that it will happen. And I've seen it happen to countless other people. Like I said, I have all of those things, and that's what they told me to get when I first got here. And I do service. And I pretty much have done that since I did. One thing I do like to do is to get centered. All that reading that y'all do at the beginning of it kind of got me messed up, so I'm going to do a little bit of my own. nothing other than that. It's just sometimes it helps me, sometimes it don't, but I always read it just because it doesn't. And the reason I read it is because I don't know where my talk's going to go, because beforehand, my wife and I, we always, you know, we say the third step prayer and we ask God to give the talk. We don't know where the talk's going to go, but sometimes it goes one way, sometimes it doesn't. But I always read this just in case. And it comes from our book. If I reference the book, I mean the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's the only book that I refer to here. It's the only book that I use. It's the only book that I really believe in. I do use other conference-approved literature. But if I reference the book, it's going to be the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's in We Agnostics. It's where I found the God of my understanding and here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's on page 50. And it says, in our personal stories, you'll find a wide variation in the way each teller, that would be me, approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself. Whether we agree with a particular approach or conception seems to make little difference. Experience has taught us that these are matters about which, for our purpose, we need not be worried. They are questions for each individual to settle for himself. And if I do or don't say anything to help someone here today, or if I mention a God of my understanding that is different than one of your understanding, that's the great thing that Alcoholics Anonymous offers the law. You know, to get to God of our own understanding. And it's the thing to save my life. Because that was the one thing that let me in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I didn't have to choose your conception of God when I got here. Now, I've gone beyond that point, and I've understood the God that they talk about in here, and I understood the God, you know, that I have today. And we'll leave that where it is and where my story goes. It may go there and it may not go there. But if it does, you know, I know without a shadow of a doubt that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a religious program, but it's highly spiritual. It's highly spiritual when we close most meetings with the Lord's Prayer. And it offends some people, you know, but it never offended me. So I join in with it, and that's the way it is. And if it offends you, just get back out and let the other people join hands. If it doesn't offend you, don't say it. Do whatever you want to do here. That's the great fact about Alcoholics Anonymous. It's autonomous. Our fourth tradition says it all. We have different things in different groups as long as it don't affect other groups. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is encompassing. It is here for us all. Hey, if you don't like what they're doing here, get you a coffee pot. Get you another alcoholic, as long as it's for the purpose of, maintaining sobriety. Now, get off of that part there and just go on with my story. And the first drink I can remember taking of any significance, and I can remember this well, is 8 years old. And my stepfather was a prankster. He'd do things that, I say stepfather, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but he's a prankster. He'd do things like he'd give you a hot pepper and give you a dollar if you could eat it. Now, he could raise some pretty hot peppers, but I like money. So I could eat that hot pepper. Now, I can eat some pretty hot peppers today, and I like hot food, but, you know, hold the spark plug while you do it. You know, see if the lawnmower why it wouldn't start. This day, he poured liquor in the bottom of two glasses, my brother and I, and he put change in the bottom of it. And if you could drink it without turning it down, you could have the change in the bottom of it. And something tells me, something I remember about that is I don't remember counting the change in the bottom of it. I remember looking to see which one had the most in it. Because by the time I was 8 years old, I had seen enough drinking to know that that stuff was the stuff that made the things go on. I'd known enough about that stuff that, you know, there was a lot that went along with that stuff. And from that day on, it was on. You know, he became my drinking partner for the next 4 years. I become his ally for the next 4 years. And I say for the next 4 years because it took 4 years for my mom and him, through all the fights and everything else, to divorce, you know. And a lot went on between that time and this time that I won't get into, but, you know, I got into with my sponsor and things and stuff that you need to. But, you know, he became the only father that I would ever know. My father was killed when I was 15 months old, and he was robbed and killed. And I never knew other than what people told me about it. He was a great man. I choose not to go try to find out anything any different. But my father was born in Sigleti. I'm in Ellison. His grandfather was disowned. His name was taken away because of his alcoholism. That's alcoholism. When your whole family disowns you for the way that you drank and the way that you acted when you drank. You know, I had the piece of paper at home with all the people that changed their last name when they disown you. You know, that's alcoholism. So they knew a little bit on that side of the family, too. Another man that was in our family was my mother's father. Him and all his brothers, what they called it back then, was bad to drink. All alcoholism. I knew a little bit about drinking. I participated in it. It just picked up when I got 12. Because I started branching out. I'd like to become a man. Because when he left, Mom had to go to work. There wasn't any kind of no one watching, no one doing anything like that. So I just did what I kind of wanted to. Tried to go to school, you know, because my school was directly linked to the Social Security check. If I quit, the Social Security quit. I was the last of the three kids to get it. My brother before me quit. My sister quit. I was the last one of the three kids that was getting the Social Security. I knew that. other things were happening, you know, during the schools, and we were moving a lot. You know, I do remember that. So, you know, when you move a lot like that, you don't tend to keep up. But I do remember one teacher telling me one time, I had a lot of questions about a particular subject. She said, you know, aren't you keeping up? Are you stupid or something? And I just remember that feeling, you know, the scales in it that goes along with that kind of stuff. And I said, yeah, are you? You know, to myself. I just threw the paper up front. And then I just kind of like quit trying to learn for a while, but I kept attending, you know. I could do math pretty good and stuff like that, but something about my reading and comprehending was different than other people's, you know. I just couldn't keep up with that kind of stuff. The one thing good about it is with all the moving, they couldn't keep up and catch up with me fast enough, you know. So by the time I got and graduated, my drinking was such, my partying was such, no one really caught up with me enough. I saw that I had a good chance to graduate. I went back home to Arkansas, we're right out of Memphis, Tennessee, in West Memphis, Arkansas. Had a chance to graduate there. There was one guidance counselor he knew, and he knew that if I didn't graduate that year, I would never graduate, that I wouldn't be back. And I think I missed 43 days, and he was able to miss 25, and he had flown. So they said that we'll call y'all. We will call you if you don't graduate. Well, I just waited for the phone to ring. I just knew that I wasn't going to graduate. You know, the phone never rang. Well, I had to scramble around to get me a cap and gown because I called and he said, well, you know, I can't flunk you. You got 22 or, you know, you have 22 credits. Well, what happened is all the different school districts and stuff, the states, they added them different. Basically, what he did is he gave me a diploma. When I walked across that stage to get that diploma, I knew two things. I knew I made my mother happy because I was the first one of this side of the family, her side of the family, to ever graduate high school. And the second thing I knew, that I was a phony. I couldn't even read. Don't get me wrong, I could read. I was smarter than most people, but I couldn't comprehend what I read. But no one really knew. And the other one was that I was drinking like nobody's business. And I worked and drank and went to school. I did all those kind of things. But, you know, everyone else was talking about going off to college and doing all those kind of things. When I did my SATs, I just kind of colored them, you know, and did that. I don't even know what my score was. I didn't even apply to college. I didn't do all that. I just, you know, I decided I was going to come off to Virginia. I had a sister living here. Because two of the times that we had moved before, we landed in Richmond, Virginia. And I had a sister that said, just come up here and live with me. I got an extra bedroom. And I did, and I remember pulling my little graduation money and stuff together. I had a suitcase. And I tell you, I was a sad shape, man. I didn't have a whole lot. I was 6'1", the same height pretty much I am now. I had, you know, very little clothes. The only thing I had was in a suitcase. I had one pair of shoes, and the soles on them were so thin, I could step on bubble gum and tell you what flavor it was. But I brought, you know, I brought my raggedy butt to Virginia, and here I come, you know, all of me. And you know, I got here in big city of Richmond. I was ready. The other thing was you could still drink at 18 then. You know, they were getting ready to make Memphis and Tennessee 21. They weren't going to retro that. In Virginia, you could drink at 18. They were later to change that to 21, but if you was already 18, you were good to go. I hit the ground running when I got here. The other thing was is that when I got in that airplane, this is pretty significant to me. I was flying over city to city, and I was looking down saying, wonder how old you got to be to drink there. I wonder how they drink over there. I'm 18 years old and already saying that I'm gonna just drink beer when I get to Virginia. Because I can't drink liquor like most people can. I just get in too big of trouble. You know, we went to the state championship that year in my high school year, and I'd gotten drunk in a blackout drunk. And something told me to take a pistol with me. These are things today that are just unheard of. You know, you don't do these things or they'll expel you, lock you up, do all kinds of stuff. They had some sniper or something on Highway 40 way down, and, you know, something just told me just be the big shot, take the pistol with me, and their big fight just broke out, and, you know, I'll bring the pistol out, you know. Well, some people had saw that, was, you know, and all this other stuff. No one really told them who it really was. So some other kids kind of got in trouble because they wouldn't tell, but no one really told who it really was, you know, because the gun wasn't there. Well, I threw the gun away coming home. So, you know, it wasn't nothing but he say, she say stuff. I was doing things like that in blackouts already. And I was just 18 years old. I have a special place in my heart for young people trying to get sober today. But there wasn't a shadow of a doubt that at 18 years old, I could have benefited from everything that this program has to offer. You know, and I had a lot of years to go. I was lucky enough to get a job right away. My sister's boyfriend was working for a company up there that pretty established company, and he apologized to me. He said, well, you know, this is just a small job. He said that, you know, you can just get it to start with, and, you know, after a while you find you a better job. Shoot, that job was paying $5.32 an hour. That was 1979. I said, I couldn't read much, but I sure could add. That's over $200 a week, you know. My total bills didn't even come up to $200. You know, so I had plenty of money, you know, to do what I wanted to do, to drink and everything. And I was doing it, you know, and I thought, like Bill said, I had arrived. And I had. And I went to the work. Went to work right then for the company that I was to work for 25 solid years. And things were to happen, you know, like I said. You know, started getting in trouble right away, drinking, blackouts, getting drinking. I said, well, you know, I met a girl, first thing you want to do is, hey, get married. Things happen. My first marriage, I'll go through it. You know, we start numbering our wives when we're alcoholics because a lot of times we do that. I promise I won't. I'll spare you the details of a lot of. My first marriage ended because she said she wasn't going to be married to an alcoholic like her father. Now I watched him drink 2 quarts a night. No self-respecting alcoholic is going to stay married to a woman that's going to limit them to two quarts a night. Not at 19 years old, please. After that, I got into some real big legal trouble because I got in a fight and I ran over a guy with a car, and they call that attempted murder in Virginia, and, you know, and things like that. But my boss thought enough of me in the way I worked. He bonded me out of jail. Just so happened the guy hit me first, and we had charges against each other, and they all got dropped, and he sued me, and he got his money, and the next thing you know, I'm off and running again. I said, but, you know, I really got to settle down. Married again. Well, this time I married someone that didn't care how I drank. But she drank just like I did. Matter of fact, we fight over who'd get the most out of a 12-pack most times. But, and then my brother, he was hitting on the 12-pack too, but that's a lot of another story. But the thing is that we started having children. And, you know, that marriage was rocky from the beginning. And we had 3 beautiful children. And, God knows. They didn't ask for it, but it was rocky, rocky, rocky. And, you know, I can't claim a whole lot of this, but my children turned out to be 3 of the finest young adults that you could ever wish for. Now, their mothers turned around to be a very good, productive citizen. Without a program or anything. She went to college after she divorced me, went to college. She's a, you know, she's doing her own thing. She's raising children. I pay my child support. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to be a father and all that's been a good thing. And that's all where it is. But it wasn't right away. You know, these are things that probably divorce was needed in that, especially at that time. This is way before Alcoholics Anonymous. But one time when we got ready to split up, this was starting to be the end, you know. We took off and we got in a big fight and we're split up and one thing happened to another and I go to the doctor and I tell the doctor I just can't sleep at day. And the doctor tells me that, well, you're going through a divorce, you know. And they had a miracle drug then. It's the early 90s. And that would help you sleep. It's called a divorce pill. And it's, I forgot what it was now, but it's some kind of sedative that they give you, and Xanax. See, I forgot. Xanax, they gave me Xanax. She said, now, take this right here every morning when you get off, and you can, you know, help you go to sleep. Come back and see me in 2 weeks. So I took it, and it helped me sleep about 4 hours, the days I take it and everything. And I go back, and I talk to her, and she said, well, how does it do? And I said, well, it does. That's good, but I don't sleep about 4 hours, and I'd be wide open, wide awake. She said, well, I tell you what you do. She said, double up on it. But you can only take it 2 days in a row, and on the third day, you can't take it because this is addictive now. Like, I care. But this is addictive, so you don't take it the third day. Well, I'm a good alcoholic now, so I took it the first 2 days, and I did. I slept. I needed to rest. I needed to rest, and on the third day, I said, well, I don't have to take my medicine today so I could drink. No medicine day, drink day. So, man, I did. I got off that day, and I drank, and the next day's medicine day. Is it drink day or medicine day? So I went on, took me 2 of them, and I said, well, I can drink a quart anyway or whatever it was. Well, it's drink day, quart day. Is it drink day, medicine day? I got confused for a cycle of about a few of them pills, and something happened when you drink and take them things together, you get a little mean, or at least I did anyway, and next thing you know, the fight's on the telephone. She said a few things, and I just said, the heck with it, and I just took them all. Needless to say, one thing led to another, and through a few miracles, my brother in Mississippi called an ambulance to come get me here in Virginia. And I ended up on a gurney. And they pretty much charcoaled me, saved my life, and I ended up in Chippendale Hospital at ICU unit. And the only thing I can remember next is being very, very sore. And my children coming in there to see me. At this time, they're very little. And I had to look my babies in the eyes. And I tell you, they tell me in Alcoholics Anonymous, you got to hit a bottom. And I believe that with all my heart. You have to hit a bottom. You've got to hit some kind of bottom to get sober or want to get sober or whatever. And I did. I mean, I just knew that that was it. I knew that I'd never, ever touch another drink in my life. I'm laying there. And I said, when I woke up, I just knew that I had another chance. And God had given me another chance. And my babies asked me what happened. And I told them, you know, I said, God gave me another chance to live. You know, and I was thinking and laying in that bed that, you know, here I grew up without a father. That my daddy, when I was 15 months old, got shot and got killed. And my brother and my sister and myself, we had to grow up without even knowing a father. And I almost took these babies' father from me. I just remember feeling the feelings that I felt all my life, not knowing. And here my babies did know me, but they were going to know me and know the drugs and the alcohol and the stuff that I did to my body and just took it and took it away from them right just there and there. And I just told them I'd never, ever do that again. And I promised them. And I meant every bit of it. I tell you, I meant every single word of it. And the doctors come in and they said that you wouldn't have done that had you not been drinking. And I believe them. So when can I go home? And they said, well, we got other plans. And they told me about this treatment center down there in the hospital. And they said, well, either you go to the second floor or the third floor. The third floor is for the people that try to commit suicide. The second floor is for alcohol and drug rehabilitation. And I scratched my head a real quick second, said second floor, and asked if they had TVs and stuff like that. And he wasn't very much amused, but he... You know, he told me about what was going to happen over the next few days, and it did. And I went over there to Tucker Pavilion, and I proceeded to go over there and help everybody else because there was a lot of people over there, you know, and they really were sad. Because I just tried to commit suicide, basically, in a blackout. And, you know, if it hadn't been for drinking, I wouldn't have done anything, right? You know. But I tell you, just like Bill said, fear sobered me. For a bit. You know, I had watched my grandfather, my mother's father, stay sober for 7 years, you know, during my life. He's the man that taught me how to take that next morning drink. I watched him have to drink. A lot of this is before my drinking ever got really, really bad. I watched all of this go. I gave him on his dying bed Miller ponies with a straw because I knew he had to have them when he had bone cancer dying. And I heard him describe some ugly scenes about three men at the end of the bed and all these kind of things. Things I didn't really want to hear, all this kind of stuff, but I still gave him the Millers. You know. And so I knew about where I was heading, about all this stuff if I didn't continue on. That was fear for me. Plus the fact that I've made my promise to my kids. I knew I didn't have to worry about any of that. Plus, I was going to IOP the day of Saturday. As long as I was going there, I was going to be okay. And I did that. I didn't need a sponsor. Well, they did try to introduce me to one. Said he was a big book thumper, and I remember about the reading. I said, ooh, I don't need one of them. You know, so they mentioned a book and reading, you know. I just, no, I don't need that. And then, you know, go to some other meetings, and I'd been to a few of them, and you know, I'd go to my group sessions, and they were trying to tell me about stay away from women for a week. Or they start off with 6 months. Don't get in a relationship for 6 months. Well, of course, they tried a year, then 6 months, and then I'm defiant. They said, just don't go out tonight. And, you know, I'm defying and all this. But, you know, that's just what they were doing. And it all led to all that stuff. And I'm just knowing that I would not do it. But what I did do is I got me a roommate that was in the program. So she was kind of getting active and everything. And So she would bring all these recovering people that would get on my nerves over to the house, and they'd lay up and watch movies on my VCR or my TV, and ask me, did I want to join them? And I said, yeah, right. You know, but I was doing everything wrong. I just was not in the program at all. You know, I was working two jobs trying to pay the child support and do all the other kind of stuff that the book tells you not to do. Needless to say, 11 months. That's the bit that the fear sold me for. I was a big NASCAR fan. And April 1st, 1993, Alec Kowicki was flying from one track to the other track to come over, and his plane crashed. I was devastated. The past year, we had been champion. You know, we had gone from hardly nobody to a champion. We had been champion. I'm saying we because I rode every race with him. I went to see him. I did everything, man. Just we. I mean, I was a big Alec Kowicki fan. My license plate was Alec Kowicki number one in 92. That goes to show you, I was an Alec Kowicki fan. And he was dead. Young. I remember something that I always said, only the good die young. And I've been close to a relapse for about 2 months. I've been going line dancing. You know, I bought me these slick clothes, you know, nice boots, the works, and I've been out there drinking these funny-looking beers. I figured out later on that non-alcoholic beers are for non-alcoholics. Trust me. But I didn't want nobody to look at what I was drinking and don't think I won't drink it. I just turned the label in my hand, and they think I'm drinking a beer like they are, you know. It's all about appearance, people. It's about the appearance of it. But the thing being is I was on a relapse for a while. And as soon as that happened, it gave me all the excuse I needed. I wanted the good die young. 2 years and 24 days, I drank for the sickest reasons of all, for oblivion. I just wanted to be numb. I drank like I'd never drank before. Before, I would drink weekends. I'd drink in between. I'd drink a few beers to maintain. I'd do whatever it was. I'd blackout drink every time I drank, but I drank this. But then it started a progression rate that I couldn't stop. You know, I couldn't stop. I'd know I'd have to go to work and it didn't matter. You know, I know I'd had the kids and it didn't matter. I'd stop getting my kids. I'd stop doing things that, you know, that really mattered to me more than anything. I'd stop calling and keeping in touch with my mom. Just the sickest reasons of all. Back to my last 6 months, you know, I'd gotten another DUI. That would make my second one. You know, when I got my first public drunk, I remember back when I was 18 years old, I was so humiliated. My girlfriend, that was later to be my first wife, had to come and buy me out. How humiliating that was. First time I went to jail. And to pay $40 and to get me out of the handcuffs and do all this stuff, it was just humiliating. When I got my last one, I was so mad that I was inconvenienced. And my $40 was more money than I had out of my drinking money. You know? And I didn't care about the embarrassment. The only thing got me is they were laughing at me, wondering what I was drinking because I smelled so bad. You know, and it was coming out of my skin so bad. And the judge or the magistrate was trying to tell me that I had to come to jail and do a week that, you know, the next day. Why wouldn't I just stay and do my week? And I said, I can get drunk twice more before then. And that's where I was. It wasn't funny. It wasn't, I mean, it was just where I was. I didn't care. I just wanted to drink. And it was bad. I couldn't get back to the rooms. I just knew. I knew the solution was here, but I just knew it wasn't for me. One thing about doing the DUI, they sentenced me to 4 meetings that I had to have done before I could complete it. I had 3 days to do them in. I wasn't procrastinating, was I? So I ended up on a noon meeting in Richmond. And they turned around and changed the topic when they realized why I was there. And they turned it around for me and they started back on the first step and they said a few things that I really needed to hear. If you've never been to a meeting where they turn it around on you, you hadn't been to enough meetings. And they started talking about the language of the heart. And it started hitting me between the eyes. And I realized that they did care. And they cared about me. And I knew if I do the simple things like get a sponsor, Get a home group. Talk about God. Work the steps. Do those things that I probably could stay sober like the rest of them would. Because I saw people in that meeting. One of them in particular was the one chairing that meeting, was so sick when I left there 2 years or so ago, was talking and making intelligent sense. There was other people in that meeting that I would have never thought would have got sober that were sober. And that was to happen two and three more times that week, and I was just saying, okay, God, I got your message. But the biggest thing was is that I ran into a buddy of mine that I had been in treatment with 2 years before and went to aftercare with, and it was so neat to see Jim. I said, Jim, that's good, you know. And the thing about that was is that to see him for a couple of meetings and everything and thinking that we was going to be able to hang out and stuff with him, and the thing with Jim was that, you know, I didn't see him for a couple of days. And I asked J.D., who was my first boss, I said, have you seen Jim? He said, you didn't hear? And I said, no. He said, Jim got drunk. And he shot himself. I said, oh, man. I wasn't ready for that. But it scared me. And I remember saying, why him and not me? I remember asking God, getting on my knees again and saying, why him and not me? And I prayed for the second time because I had prayed a couple of weeks before that and asked God, you know, I think we all said the first step prayer. Why him and not me? I said. I started getting busy then. I was going to a 12-and-12 meeting and you know, things were going on and like that. And I remember being in treatment there and I seen a guy named Father Martin. I don't know. I guess everybody's pretty much familiar with him. And I seen him doing a chalk talk thing. But a flyer came around somewhere and it said that he was doing a talk in Fredericksburg. And I said, I wouldn't mind going and seeing that, you know, and doing it. But what I did is I went up to Fredericksburg to see him. And he made a big impression on me that day. A big impression. But the biggest thing that he did that day was, you know, I just started feeling it. And for some reason, when we got up to say the Lord's Prayer, I felt something. What it was, I don't know. It was a tingle. But what I felt was, you know, that I was going to be okay. I felt the tingle, but I wanted to feel it again and again and again. So they said they were selling the tape. I wasn't too bright, I guess, because I thought if I bought that tape, I could listen to it and feel it again and again and again. But I bought that tape, and I wanted to listen to that tape over and over again. But they said they were selling it, and it was making it around the corner. When I walked around the corner, they had this big table of tapes. I said, wow. They had the big book on tape. That was my biggest fear. A guy named Joe and Charlie was on these tapes. And I bought them. I barely had enough money, but I bought them. And I went home, and a new experience started in my life. I couldn't get home fast enough every day to listen to the next tape. And the big book, as it said on there, woke to me. And I started seeing a different side of everything happen. And I went through the book as they went through the book with me. Now, it was a set from Maryland. So it wasn't the McHugh, it was McQuaney, I guess. And we went through the thing there, and it had a profound change on me. The 12-and-12 meeting that I had been going to, I was ready. I had a fourth step in my hand. And I went and got a different sponsor because the sponsor I had from the time, he really wasn't talking about steps and stuff. He'd moved to the Eastern Shore, so I went back and asked the guy that I saw. It really looked like he was a closed-mouth guy that could talk about in here. And I asked him to sponsor me. He said, yeah. He said, well, where are you in the book? And I started off with the first three steps was, and I said, I got a four step here. Are you ready? You know, because I was ready. Oh, yeah. But one thing good about that is that he was ready. And after he heard this fifth step, he asked me, was I ready? And I said, for what? He said, to start working with others. You know. And I said, well, now he knew that I didn't have anything nobody wanted. But he knew that that was going to jumpstart me into getting ready with the rest of this program. And as soon as I was, I got two pretty sick individuals, I guess you could say, other than the fact that I was willing. And I prayed for the willingness. And, you know, the first individual I got, he was in the rooms, and he just you know, for lack of another word, he was not all there in his head. But he wanted to come to meetings. And the service work I got was to go get him and bring him to meetings. Second individual I got was coming out of a state hospital. I sponsored that individual for 15 months. That was to later become probably one of the closest relationships to my sister through their sister, all through her death, and my mother's best friends. You never know what's going to happen. Now, normally I wouldn't sponsor that individual, but my sponsor said, if you can help her, help her. She was a gay individual, but she was a good friend of my sister, and I helped her. And eventually I turned her to someone else, but she stayed sober for 15 months the first go around. Now, I had no intention of, you know, doing things right or wrong or anything else, and that's a debatable situation. But I did it all the right way, you know. And there's, like I said, something earlier on in my sobriety. But, you know, God must have knew what I was doing because it was profound later in my life, this past couple of years. She's like a sister to me today. Later, like I said, things were just happening. 2.5 years sober, I was about to lose my mind. I went to Atlanta for a month, you know, and things were happening. Things were happening. I was away from. You ever heard those analogy? If you're a banana and you get away from your bunch, you're about to get peeled. You know, and that was me. But I found myself in a bar with a group of guys from the group, and I found myself in a bar counting people's drinks, and that wasn't good for me. And so I called another guy from Richmond that I knew, and I asked him to sponsor me. When I got back, I got into another set of tapes and everything else, and we got together and went back through this book. And I put the nails in the coffin in the first step. Something I didn't do. I did 1, 2, and 3 real fast. And I got into the first 4 chapters of this book like I never did before. I kind of brushed through them in them tapes the first time. You know, I went to that first sponsor and said, I got a 4-step. So we started in chapter 5. Didn't go through the book. I went through the book with this sponsor. And I go through the book with everyone I sponsor now. Number one is I got a God of my understanding at 2.5 years sober. Deep down in every man, woman, and child, the fundamental ideal of God is in here. You know, I don't know who you are when you come in here, when you say that you're this and that or this and that. If I'm not willing to take you through the first 4 chapters of this book, I can't tell you nothing. But if I'm willing to bring you and sit you down, if you've got a problem with alcohol, let's sit down and figure out who you are. Then if you belong here, fine. If you don't belong here, fine. If you're an alcoholic and an addict, then maybe you need Alcoholics Anonymous and NA. Or you just, Alcoholics Anonymous may help you. I don't know. But let me show you the first 4 chapters of this book. And you make the decision. Now, I can't tell you. But I'm not going to turn my back on you. I've sponsored numerous of guys that found out this is all they need. I sponsored a few guys that found out that's what they need. I sponsored a few guys that found out that the outside world's what they need. Don't know where they're at or what it is, but it's my responsibility to do the work, to show them all the same. I've got lifetime friends. You know, we've traveled everywhere. You know, main thing is that I went back through the steps, and I did find a God. And the biggest one was this. The second step, and finding that was the deep down within, and putting the nails in the coffin. Because if I'm sitting in a bar in Atlanta, counting people's drinks, something was wrong with my foundation. Something was wrong with my first step. And it's good for me to be able to recognize it, and have someone recognize it, and to go back and find out everything, and go back and putting up, well, like I said, putting the nails in the coffin. We've gone through a lot of things in sobriety that had I not done that, it would have been tested. Like I said, one thing it was that I did is that I got busy right away. I got busy in service work because there was a lot of painful things. As I worked through the fourth and fifth step, I found out who I was and the character defects and stuff. And eighth and ninth step, in the eighth step I took and I did that lesson, you know, I did that and I put four names over on the column that I couldn't make amends to. There was a list of people. My stepfather was over there. My brother was over there. There was two other individuals was over there. And at 5 years sober, you know, at 5 years sober, they were still over there because they lay dormant over there. And I tell you, you know, my brother had come to visit, my older brother, had come to visit at Christmas. And he's sitting there and he's talking to me about 20 minutes into the conversation. He asked me if he offended me in any kind of way. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I've been talking to you for 20 minutes. You ain't heard a word I said." And I realized he was right. He's just talking to me. I'm staring off and thinking about something else. I realized that he was over there. I still resented my brother. I haven't done anything about this resentment. I haven't done anything about all the other kind of stuff. As he left and went away, I realized I did all that. He lived in Florida. We were able to start rebuilding some of that stuff. And I realized that there was three names still left on there, and all I could do was pray about it. Within a week, I was in Richmond. The other three was in, well, one was in like in the Little Rock area. The other two was in the Arkansas area, or the Memphis area. And God gave me a trip. I say God because it couldn't happen no other way. To Greenville, Mississippi. And if you got a map anytime, anywhere soon, look at Greenville, Mississippi and look at where it goes. 100 miles each way. And I was able to go back and do things about those two. Now, nothing profound happened out of the other ones, but I was able to go back to my stepfather, who I had some real bad resentments against. And I didn't go back and do anything other than to see all the stuff that I had problems with, the snapping of the fingers, the things and that, and to see him in a different light, because I saw him as a monster. And to see him that he wasn't a monster was that. You know, and that was to later play another part. You know, and to go back to the other town, and I wasn't able to see the people, but to go back to the places and pray in front of them to know what may come ahead next time. And to tell the guys that I sponsored to do the same kind of thing, because you never know what's going to happen, you know, in those kind of things. I just recently had a guy that I'm sponsoring do the same thing to a son that he hadn't seen since he was a kid, and a father that he couldn't make amends to, and a brother and his mother. And he said, "There's no way he can go back through that door." I said, "Just send the card." Because I seen and heard other people say, "Do it, just send the card." Well, his father's got dementia and Alzheimer's, so he's got that relationship. His father's living next door to him now. And he's getting ready to start his relationship with his son, a kid that he hadn't seen since he was little. So you just send the card. Just do the things. Just say the prayer. Do whatever you do. just things, just doing it. There's that line in here. Things start happening. I got busy in service, like I said, just to keep from doing those things. It took me 5 years to get there, and I was mad. But I got a good foundation. Other things happened, but I was busy in service, and I had a good friend. And the next thing you know, we're looking at each other more so than friendship, and we ended up married. She was one of the busiest people I know in service work, and so was I. But we got married, and almost immediately, God bless her, my life went to hell in a handbasket. I mean, you know, she started traveling with me. I had a traveling job. She started traveling with me, gave up her job. Not many people would do that. She's 7 years sober, more sober than I am. We go to traveling and all this stuff, but the next thing you know, I'm losing my job after 25 years. You know, so we end up in another part of Mississippi. But at the same time, they tell me my sister's diagnosed with sarcoma cancer, 45 years old, who has two young kids, who wants me to be the one calling the shots in her life. You know, she had just gotten married to a guy that was a crack addict for 10 years, and she didn't even know it. He had been clean for some few months prior to her meeting him, and, you know, just things just started happening. So our savings started getting eaten away. You know, and she's sitting on the sideline watching all this happen and being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had our friends back here, but we were all alone moving into all these other places. You know, thank God she had the foundation she had. Anytime she could have just walked away from it. Now, I tell you, I got kind of crazy during this time, but we kept our commitments. And I kept her at my side. And I'm going to tell you, like I said, everything just was going crazy. We ended up in Fairmont, North Carolina, which is another end of the state. Now, we've got six kids together. You know, together she's got three and I got three. They're all in Richmond area. And when we were sitting up in Fairmont one day and we'd gone to a meeting, we looked at each other, why don't we move back to Richmond? You know? We just laughed at each other. It's just the way things go. We just laughed at each other and said, why not, you know? It wasn't 2 days and the phone rang, and my first sponsor that moved to the Eastern Shore and moved back to Richmond, he asked my current sponsor for my phone number. And then called me up and offered me a job back in Richmond, basically doing what I'm doing. Her sister-in-law, the next day, called and said, well, we got a house for rent. Well, my neighbor's got a house for rent, so we moved back. It all happened within a week's time. You know, so we're back in Richmond, Virginia. And that was good for about a year and a half. You know, I'm not dealing with stuff. I'm still not dealing with stuff. I lost a 25-year job. It's piling up. I lost a sister that we were like this through life. We grew up hard. You know, I'm still not dealing with stuff. She's saying, Dennis, I love you, but, you know, don't you think you need to call Ross? You know, and lovingly, I mean, I'm telling you, she's Dennis. You know, this, I love you. But it all boils down to about maybe 6 months ago. You know, things started going wrong. I'm hating my job. It got us back to Richmond, but I'm hating it. It's not what I do. It's not my creativity. You know, and my job was my life. My other job was, you know, it just, I've been on it since I was 18 years old. What happened was, you know, she finally said, Dennis, don't you think you need to do this? Well, you know, I started considering all that. And I started doing some other writing, and then I did, and I got with it. The moral of the story is that I was overdue for another inventory. And I sat down, and I sat down with my sponsor, and I did this other inventory. And almost immediately, things started opening back up. The phone started ringing. Jobs I applied for called me up, you know. And then I started, you know, like I said, I'm now employed in a job that I just love to death. It's more like what I do, and it's more like it is, and they treat me like they want me there. And the funny thing about it is when I gave my resignation, the other company, and tell me if you know anything about this, they will test you. They called me in there, and I said I love money all the way back when I was a kid. And they offered me double my salary for the next 16 weeks. You know, cash money, they said, just to stay. So we get this company sold, we get on things, just to and my eyes light up, wow. I said, will you give me 4 weeks up front? Sure, we'll write you a check Friday. Wow, let me call her. Well, I called my sponsor and I called my father-in-law, who was, you know, CPA before this. And I kind of like had talked to him. And everything. He'd been through two big shutdowns before. You got to know where you can go for your resources and stuff like that. And he said, why don't you go for the sure thing? And he just kept coming through my head. And then I talked to her about it. You know, we could always use that kind of money. $1,500 a week for 12, 16 weeks, you know, is a lot of money. You know, you could always use that kind of money. And just saying, to go back and tell them people no, it's probably the best feeling I could have ever done. I'm going with these people that's talking about my future. Not talking about a 16-week period, you know. And to be able to walk into this new job, use the principles, you know, in this program has always served me well. We were able to do that. The other thing my sponsor has always been able to do for me is, you know, you don't sit on the outside, but to see it on the one-on-one, he recognized my reading problem. I got to read it three times to get it. He made me read my first novel. I went on vacation with him and his wife. Now, it was the Left Behind series, first book. I read it. I hadn't read one since. But I know how to read because they taught me how to read. I don't have a comprehension problem. I have a problem getting it from one to the other, but everything I hear, I remember. I just read out loud. I want to remember. Just read it out loud. You know. But, you know, that's just the thing is, there's nothing wrong with my IQ. I had the guy check it. You know, anything that I do or say or anything else, I got above average IQ, just like most of us do. I've helped so many people just with that little bit of knowledge. You know, you're reading, nothing wrong with that. You know, just being able to hear it. They come back and tell me, oh, man, it works so much better. Sometimes I daydream away, but if you just read it and read it out loud, you can get it so much better. Krista said last week, she talked about our marriage, you know, it's better than the dream. Her kids love me so much. You know, they welcome me into her life so much that, I'm overwhelmed sometimes. They treat me just like I was their dad, you know, and they're grown. My kids don't see us as much and everything. They've gone through a stage of, you know, my dad hadn't been in my life and all that stuff when we was moved and stuff. And they're younger, but they're coming around. You know, I got two girls and a boy. My son just graduated from Virginia Tech. He's different, a little different. He got his first job, and he called me yesterday, and he's going to be up in Christiansburg as a teacher. And he's just overwhelmed. He's going to be teaching kids with alcohol and drug abuse problems and stuff like that. But he's just overwhelmed. He don't know anything about that, but he just knows about his dad was. You know, my girls are doing good. All the kids are doing good. You know, life couldn't be any better because we're just putting one foot in front of the other. You know, where I would be without this program, I just don't know. Where I would be without this woman, I just don't know. I'm sure I would be, you know, still in this program, but like I said, the best thing to do is to get in here and to get busy. I've been busy in the district again. I'm going back through this, and I've been approached about possibly running for DCM. You know, I was ADCM before I left the state, and some people have approached me about running for it. I'm excited. You know, that's where I was going to be prior to leaving the state of Virginia, so it's just like picking back up, and it's a real good thing. Because it's where my love is, in the state of Virginia. And so, I mean, that's where I know so many people from the state. And there's so many meetings in the Richmond area, so many, over 300 meetings in the Richmond area. So if you don't like one there, you go over here, you know. And that's where the traditions and the steps, and I mean, really the traditions come into play, you know. Especially the third, fourth, and fifth always come into play. Because some meetings you go into, you don't even know if it is an AA meeting. You know, and some meetings you go into is great AA meetings. Some, yeah, but you always got more to go to. Smaller areas, you're pretty well stuck. You don't have that many. And we know that, you know, we've been to smaller areas and larger areas, so we know the difference between both. We just started the new one that we did, and they're both closed meetings, and that's a good thing. I think that the area needed more closed meetings. And at the time frame that it did, and we thought about, you know, autonomy when we did, and autonomy when we did, you know, that it needed that kind of meeting at that time frame. We really thought about what the area needed before we just went and opened another meeting. Last thing it needed was another meeting. What kind of meeting did it need? And those kind of things. I guess I'm finished, but I really want to thank y'all for inviting us up to, you know, share with you. And thanks.